at 5. Nigella Lawson's been accused of lying in court and allowing her children to smoke cannabis. The claims were made by her former personal assistant, Elisabetta Grillo, who denies defrauding the TV cook and her ex-husband. Our reporter Ian Woods at Isleworth Crown Court says the issue of drugs reared its head again as she was questioned about a £70 credit card transaction.
It was determined that it was for cigarettes for the children. She was asked by Miss Carpenter, what on earth do you think you were doing buying cigarettes for underage children? Elisabetta replied, well, if Nigella Lawson let them smoke weed. And at that point, Judge Robin Johnson interrupted the line of questioning.
A man from Reading has been arrested on suspicion of murdering a teenage girl. Police say he's in a relationship with Jaden Parkinson, who was last seen at Didcot railway station 10 days ago. Officers say they're becoming increasingly worried for the 17-year-old's welfare. They've been searching the Oxfordshire countryside.
It's a wide rural area between the village of Upton and Didcot. It's a path or a track that leads from that village to the general direction of Didcot. Part of it is a disused railway line.
A man accused of murdering Lee Rigby in Woolwich has offered no evidence in his defence. Michael Adebowale is on trial alongside Michael Adebolajo. They both deny murder. An estimated 100,000 people have seen Nelson Mandela's body lying in state. Hundreds broke through a police barrier after being told no one else will be allowed up to see the former president's coffin. Parents of children at a free school, which has been ordered to close, are being told there are places ready for pupils at good schools nearby. Discovery New School in Crawley will shut in April because it's failed to improve after being put in special measures. And Prince Harry has arrived at the South Pole. He and his Walking with the Wounded teammates celebrated reaching the bottom of the world at midday. That's the latest. I'm Anna Jones.
BCFM. It's Friday, 5 o'clock, and BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. Helping us review this week's news is Cotswold Lib Dem councillor Esmond Jenkins. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, hundreds of ordinary people in the southwest are continuing to give up their free time, campaigning against the proposed new nuclear power station at Hinkley Point near Bridgewater. So why are they so committed to stopping it going ahead, and what are the solutions that they'd like to see? Also, how US and UK intelligence services are out of control. We hear an analysis from former MI5 officer Annie Machon on how the intelligence services break the law with impunity and what we can do at home to stop them. Plus, Frank Sinatra's tribute to the Chicago mob and to the Kennedy assassins. Plus, Martin Summers takes us on a tour of the world's hotspots this week. That's all in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to the news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 7 Celsius and some light showers. This weekend, highs of 11 Celsius. A fairly cloudy weekend with some showers. Dry on Saturday and Sunday, fine. Next week, highs of 13 Celsius, a fairly cloudy week with showers, some of them heavy. Next weekend, 21st and 22nd of December, there's highs of 10 Celsius, sunshine and showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Yes, it's Friday the 13th once more, and I can't let that go by without a quick critique of this morning's broadcast on BBC Radio Bristol John Darvill's show. He had a Bath astrologer on who said that the first mention of Friday the 13th being unlucky was in the mid-1800s. Well, the actual origin is datable precisely to Friday the 13th of October 1307, when the Pope and the French King Philip the Fair conducted dawn raids right across France, arresting international bankers of their day, the infamous Knights Templar. Radio Bristol really should know about this because, of course, Bristol was a Templar port at the time. We also have Temple Church off Victoria Street, and Temple Mead Station is named after these notorious Crusader bankers. John Darville would do well to watch former Monty Python's comedian Terry Jones' excellent series on the Crusades, where he explains that far from fighting the good fight, this cult sacked the chief Christian city, Constantinople, and far from being Christian, were enthusiastic cannibals too. So, superstition around Friday the 13th are a little over 700 years old, and as it's a day for arresting religious fanatic cannibal bankers, it's a good omen, not a bad one. It was most probably the successor cults to the Templars, such as the Order of the Garter, the Freemasons, that considered Friday the 13th to be bad luck. So, helping us review this week's news is Cotswold Lib Dem Councillor Esmond Jenkins. Hi, Esmond, and welcome to Drive Time.
Good evening.
First of all, Esmond, give us an idea of what got you into politics and what were you doing before you became a councillor?
Well, it was what I was doing before and what I'm doing as a full-time job. I run a small legal practice in Oxfordshire. But what got me involved was the suspicions, I think, that were rumours that were circling in the Cotswold Water Park as to how easy it was for major developers to win planning permissions in an area that was supposed to be so tightly controlled and supposedly developed in the interests of conservation on the ground. That didn't seem to be the case.
Okay, you, as a lawyer, what sort of law were you practicing and what got you interested in becoming a lawyer?
Well, I started in banking. So in 2004, my wife and two young children moved from London out to the Cotswolds for a change of lifestyle, and we thought for a quieter life, but it soon became apparent that when it was announced that a green field at the end of my my garden was going to be developed into a quarry, when the local plan suggested it could only be used for quiet recreational use, and when we raised this, what we found were local authority officials basically poo-pooing the idea of that the local plan had any real weight in the discussion. So one thing led to another. I think local residents started to get increasingly involved and increasingly suspicious at some of the explanations that were given. And eventually in 2009, a local election was coming up. I hadn't been involved, ever been involved in local politics, but I was first asked by the local Tory party to the local Conservative councillor to join him. That was until I pointed out that I'd called upon him to help us expose what was going on, and he turned a blind eye. So despite my conservative roots, I said I couldn't join him. I wouldn't get into bed with them. Then the Lib Dems came along, which was at that time they only had four out of 40-odd seats on the council. And I joined with them on the minority Lib Dem council. We've now got 12 seats. So because of the water park fraud and scandal, we've had quite a big impact on Cotswold District Council.
We're going to talk a lot in the second half of this hour about fraud at the water park. But go back to your banking days. As someone who's worked in banking, what's your analysis of what's going on at the moment? Because certainly seems to me that we're caught in some kind of death spiral of debt that actually we're never going to pay these massive debts off. If you look at the actual graph of the national debt, it's going up at a rate of knots. All we're doing is we're putting fingers in the dike, it seems, with the cuts that are going on at the moment. So as someone who's worked in banking, what's your analysis for what's going on today?
I had this discussion with clients about a year ago, completely independent of this discussion today. And I think there is, you know, viewed in pure economic terms, the debt spiral is a nightmare. It's difficult to see how we could ever get to a position where the debt mountain is back under control. I explained the situation to a number of individuals or clients, and I've got to say, I think I was amazed at the sort of the reaction, and the only reaction I think that or conclusion we could come to is that the you know, Britain is too an important economy within the global economy for bankers and governments to allow it to go bang. So somehow they will keep on printing money to perpetuate the problem. But you know, if you measure in term the debt in terms of simple economics, then I would suggest it's unsustainable. But I'm perhaps not the expert to comment on that.
How come then, if this, I mean, this money is being printed, this quantitative easing, how come it just sort of seems to be going into the casino economy and very little of it finding its way into the real economy, which is virtually flatlining? We've also got these big cuts which are affecting people who, for whatever reason, partly due to the recession, can't find work. I mean, we've also got quite a few people coming into the country from elsewhere, and so the competition for jobs is increasing all the time, and yet there doesn't seem to be any more jobs out there.
Well, although I'm a card-carrying Lib Dem, I've got to say that my own views of professional politicians is quite dim. What I would suggest is that regardless of party, Conservative, Lib Dem, Labour, everybody seems focused on the short term. Nobody has any particular imagination in terms of how to create jobs in the long term, and I think the best example of that is, and it impacts us in the Cotswolds, that the only solution that those in government seem to ever have is to build more houses rather than create proper jobs. You know, yes, houses give a short-term impetus to the economy and provide roofs for people, but to me it's never seemed to be a particularly intelligent way of bringing an economy out of the doldrums.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, have you got anything to add to what Esmond's saying there? Because, you know, it certainly does look as if this debt is going to be ultimately unpayable. It's just kicking the can down the road.
Well, it's not just national governments that are in debt. I mean, personal indebtedness is rising in the in Britain and elsewhere. And, of course, that is probably what explains whatever kind of recovery we've got. People are basically going out on their credit cards again. I mean, ultimately, I totally agree that building houses and certainly building private houses to sell is the usual way that Britain conducts its business, but it's not how they do it in Germany, where house prices have been flatlining for 40, 50 years. And at dinner parties in Germany, people sit around and talk about their latest business ventures, not about the conservatories that they've recently built. And that's the difference. And we in Britain, we have what the Irish historian once called the possessor principle, that having stuff means that you get more stuff. And people don't get rewarded for doing things, they get rewarded for having stuff. So if you start off with a load of stuff, you get more stuff. And, you know, it's what Oxfam used to call the Matthew principle: to those that hath shall be given, and to those that hath not, the little they have shall be taken away. And the real problem, I'm afraid, and the Austrian school economists, who are very super free market right-wing economists, Hayekians, they've got it right. This bubble will burst. And the mainstream politicians of all parties don't want to tell people the bad news, that it's out of control and it's going to crash, because A, a lot of them don't understand that, and B, those that do want to keep mum about it because they don't want to frighten the horses. But that's the reality. I hope the civil service, the senior civil service in this country, are aware of the consequences and what may happen.
Esmond?
Yeah, no, I think it's such a daunting prospect, I think, that most people shut their minds to it. And I think I would include in that the political classes.
Some people that haven't shut their minds to it are, if you go to the top of Scotland and head off 500 miles northwest, you'll find a little country which has got the population just around about the same size as Bristol, actually. Iceland, which is rising, according to The Guardian, from the ashes of a banking collapse. This is Sunday the 6th of October, a couple of months ago now. A new mood of proud nationalism is emerging in economically resurgent Iceland after an out-of-control banking system sank the country into financial financial meltdown 5 years ago. Riding the wave of confidence is 38-year-old Prime Minister Sigmundur David Gunnlaugsson, elected in April on popular promises of mortgage relief for every homeowner. Now, seems things they've turned things around, Martin, in Iceland, and actually dishing out money, giving mortgage relief to people with mortgages, and also giving slices of cash, actually, to people who don't have a job.
Yeah, they've actually increased unemployment benefits because, of course, if you're a small community like Iceland where you've got 300,000 people, everybody knows somebody in their family who might be affected by the crisis. So there's they really do pull together and they really are in it all together. The other interesting thing about Iceland, which you haven't picked up on, is they sent four of their bankers to prison this week for several years, for each of them.
Do you think it's partly the principle then, that, and maybe you can answer this, Esmond, that Westminster, the City of London, is a long way away and there's no actual personal contact. It's almost as if it's another world. We are being managed by the city as if we are far away, and they don't actually ever talk to or meet to the people they're managing.
Well, as somebody who lived in London and worked in the city, what I would say is that you can draw a clear distinction between the City of London and the banking industry that exists there and the rest of the country. You know, there is no connection, full stop. If you go to Essex or the Home Counties, that housing market has no bearing at all on the rest of the country. It's driven largely by the bonus culture that spews out of the City of London. And you get huge distortions. And I've got to say that, it's the culture of ludicrously high salaries and ludicrous bonuses that I think has spilled out from banking and affected all manner of industries across the country.
But I mean, Icelanders, according to this article anyway, are fast on their way back to becoming among the richest people in the world, just 5 years after experiencing one of the most dramatic financial meltdowns in history. If you say Iceland was a ship, that is the 2008 banking crash, caused a lot of damage to the bridge, but the body of the ship and the engine was still in working order, says Geir Hardy, Prime Minister at the time. He added, our growth prospects for the future are now tremendous. Now, they've really turned the corner and they're steaming ahead. How can we bring this country into the same sort of state?
I don't know the specifics of Iceland, but I mean, if you take Cyprus, which I do have some dealings in, you know, people there are feeling are bearing the cost of the banking collapse there, because for every euro they had on deposit, they've now got substantially less than they had pre-banking collapse. I don't know how that equates to the Icelandic example, but I presume that the Icelandic recovery is based on industry and some form of export.
But isn't it also based, Martin, on writing off debts?
Yeah, well, they did write off the debts. The other thing they did, I mean, Cyprus, of course, is in the euro, so they've got less room for manoeuvre. I mean, Iceland is now withdrawing its application to the EU because they've basically decided that it's not in their interests. But the other thing they did, which is a bit naughty if you think about it, is a lot of British local authorities, maybe Bristol, maybe Gloucester, others, had money in the Icelandic banks because of the interest rate, and they were actually encouraged by their financial advisors stick it all in Iceland because they've got, I mean, don't forget, these banks were based in the City of London anyway, so they've got basically a subsidiary in Iceland and the main headquarters is in London. So they then said they were all Icelandic citizens were covered by deposit insurance, so they got their money back when the banks collapsed. But foreigners were not covered by Icelandic deposit insurance, and they said, if you want to bail out your citizens, that's up to you, but we're not going to. And of course, Gordon Brown at the time famously threatened them with terrorism legislation to send a gunboat, and the Icelanders just weren't having it. And what you've got is a system there where the political system is, I mean, don't forget, Iceland was probably one of the first democracies in Europe. They used to get everybody together because it's such a small place, and once a year at the All Thing. So, but what they did do, of course, the British government and the Dutch government then bailed out their own local authorities and other individuals. But of course, that then added to British and Dutch debt. So some of what Iceland has done essentially is past the parcel. I think the Icelanders are right. There's no reason why people should have their... I mean, people have got to realise if you deposit insurance doesn't necessarily cover you. I think the real question we've got to ask is why have we got... I mean, before 2003... But all Icelandic banks were, they had two banks, both owned by the government, and they did boring things like kept people's savings and lend people money for houses. And then these guys turned and said, you don't want to do it like this, you want to do it like that. And before you know it, they've got a banking system bigger than their own GDP.
Well, one of the weird things about all this, of course, is that the Chinese this year have set their own national banks on the train to be privatised. So maybe they weren't watching what was going on in Iceland. Anyway, let's go to Westminster now and Prime Minister's Questions, where the Leader of the Opposition, Ed Miliband, was putting questions to, in fact, are rather soft questions to David Cameron about MPs' pay, saying that they shouldn't have the 11% rise.
Ed Miliband.
Mr Speaker, I'm glad he agrees on this issue. Does he also agree with me that we should not let this hang around as an issue until after the general election, hanging over trust in politics? Yeah. And can I urge him to work with me to find a way, on a cross-party basis, of making IPSA think again and to stop this package happening?
My door is always open to the Right Honourable Gentleman, and I'm always happy to discuss this or indeed any other issue. I would just stress the point that this is not a final recommendation, and I think if the three party leaders and others in this House can unite behind a position of saying it wouldn't be right to make this pay rise, then I think actually that's the strongest message we can give.
Now, Esmond Jenkins, Lib Dem councillor from the Cotswolds, what's your thoughts about the rights and wrongs of an 11% pay rise for MPs?
Well, I think, like many people in the wider community, I again have a very dim view of the value of our MPs. I think the whole 11% argument, to a large extent, is being dressed up. I think you've got to look at the whole package. You've got to look at the reductions in expenses, because the headline figure of what we pay our MPs, 60-odd thousand a year, I think, currently, bears no relation to what they actually get paid by the time you factor in expenses and the costs that they're reimbursed for running their offices and employing family members, etc.
So now, we had battles in the 1800s over making sure MPs were paid properly. Now, it seems that they're going to have to suffer like everyone else. Martin, what's your thoughts about this 11% offer? Is it reasonable?
Well, I think it's politically obviously no good for any of the parties to accept it. But don't forget, when David Cameron refuses his 11%, he's a millionaire anyway, many times over. So, you know, there's an element of you know, there is a question here about what MPs should be paid. I mean, you could argue that if you're an MP working full time as an MP, you shouldn't have any other interests at all. But lots of MPs do have interests outside politics. If you were an officer working for the council, you wouldn't be allowed to do that. Why should a politician be allowed to do it? But of course, you could come back to the arguments behind the Paris Commune, where they insisted that all delegates to the Commune should be paid at the level of a skilled worker, and should be immediately revocable if their constituents didn't agree with what they wanted to do. That's a bit extreme. But on the other hand, I mean, you've got to argue what is, I mean, the Prime Minister is paid for being the Prime Minister. Was it 300 grand? That's peanuts to people working in the city. That's not even a bonus. But of course, it doesn't matter because they fill their boots when they leave office, like Tony Blair, who's now worth repeatedly 60 million.
Sounds to me, Esmond, like you're saying that the bankers should be paid far, far more, maybe, an extra three noughts on the end, or two noughts anyway, than MPs.
No, I don't think I'm saying that at all. I'm saying that it's not a... I don't have a solution, but I think bankers and their inflated salaries do not represent value for money for bank shareholders. By the same measure, I don't think MPs, if you measure what they deliver to us, represent particularly good value for the average voter.
Well, at the other end of the scale, we had a question this week from Michael Meacher, MP, Labour MP, saying 5 million people are paid less than the living wage in Britain and 750,000 nothing whatsoever.
Is the Prime Minister aware that FTSE 100 directors now get £86,000 a week on average, whilst at the other end, 5 million workers get less than the living wage, and 750,000 people who can't get a job and get sanctioned, get nothing at all, and are left to starve? Is there no end to the brutality and nastiness of Tory Britain? Yeah.
I would say to the Honourable Gentleman, Right Honourable Gentleman, who served in Labour government after Labour government with a 40p tax rate when it's now 45p, with a bonus bonanza in the city 85 times higher than it is now, he's got a lot of brass neck.
Well, that's quite interesting, because I presume Michael Meacher probably opposed what was going on when he was in the Labour governments that David Cameron's pointing out.
There. He doesn't answer the question at all. He's just saying you've got some brass neck to ask that question.
Well, he's saying that the Labour parties, when they were in power, tolerated a low tax regime and a low regulation regime of the City of London. They had 13 years to regulate the City of London, and they did nothing because they were basically in their pockets, as Michael Meacher would no doubt agree. And they could have done something and they didn't. But if they had tried to do something, George Osborne and David Cameron, and no doubt Nick Clegg and David Laws, would have been saying, oh, you're bad for this is anti-business rhetoric, blah, blah, blah. They should have been regulated as soon as the Labour Party came to power in 1997 or whenever it was. They should have re-regulated the city, which had been deregulated 10 years previously. And we are now paying an international price of catastrophe as a result of not doing the right thing.
Esmond, 5 million people paid less than the living wage, 750,000 on benefits paid nothing at all. I mean, that's a pretty horrific picture he's painting there.
Well, it is, and I think, you know, I mean, anybody who drives around the cities of Britain will see that we have a huge problem of effectively an underclass, unemployed, out of sight, living in substandard housing. I don't think it's simply a question of saying that there's you know, this is about a clash of ideologies. I think it's simply a question that people who are in a position to pay them and work in industries that have dominant or monopoly positions can pay the senior managers disproportionately. I mean, I think, you know, I'm somebody who runs a small business, and I can tell you that, you know, there is no opportunity to pay myself disproportionately. Very often months go by, I don't pay myself anything. I think for the average small business in the high street of provincial Britain, you know, it's a real battle. There is no, you know, I with some envy those in senior management positions in local authorities as well as in the larger corporates, because I think that's the dichotomy I see there between those working for large organisations who can bully the way effectively towards to what they charge, compared to small businesses who don't have the same bargaining power, and as a result can't charge these, you know, can't afford to pay them these ridiculously high salaries.
Well, for anyone that watched BBC's Question Time last night, it was quite fascinating to see it came from Johannesburg. A very fiery event it was too. Lots and lots of really passionate input. One of the sides of the whole Mandela Memorial Service this week, I mean, there's been lots and lots talked about it, was the fact that we have a really fantastic guy there. We don't have him anymore, but how is he going to be remembered? What's your thoughts, Esmond, on Mandela and what he means for us today?
Well, I think it's the example he gave. I think you know, the bit that stuck in my mind over the television coverage was the impact he had when Mandela, after his release from Robben Island and his visits to Britain and his meeting with Margaret Thatcher, she was quite taken aback by him, whereas previously she was led to, or she categorised him as a terrorist. By all accounts, he impressed her so much that she changed her mind 180 degrees, and I think that says something about the man, and you know, the way he went about his life. I think he had a capacity to forgive, which few of us can aspire to.
One of the interesting things about the memorial service this week, Martin, was that the opening words, or the first words of the actual memorial itself, were spoken by a rabbi, and yet the Israeli delegation boycotted it. We didn't have any of the senior people from Israel at all.
They didn't boycott it. Netanyahu said he was too busy and he had other things to do.
No, he said it was actually going to cost too much to go.
Yes, but he wasn't boycotting. He was just saying he didn't turn up.
But I mean,
up.
You know, I'm thinking, why can't they make it?
The politics behind that are fairly clear, because a boycott and disinvestment campaign against the Israelis is gathering speed around the world. And therefore,
I mean, some commentators are saying that actually apartheid is alive and well in Israel.
Desmond Tutu, Mandela's lifelong friend, has made it clear that he wants sanctions on Israel. That's you know, the politics carry on. I mean, just because somebody dies doesn't mean that politics ends. It's still grinding on, isn't
it? One of the most interesting bits of commentary was actually in the House of Lords this week, and we're going to go have a clip from Today in Parliament now, with Sean Curran introducing. One of the most fascinating speakers was Mandela's lawyer, Lord Joffe.
Members of the Lords also shared their memories of Nelson Mandela. The person who knew him best was the human rights lawyer, Joel, now Lord Joffe, who defended him at his trial in the early 1960s. Here's Christina Cooper.
Nelson Mandela and seven other people were all found guilty of planning a revolution and sentenced to life imprisonment. Nelson Mandela's lawyer at that trial was Lord Joffe. He was born in South Africa, but left and came to Britain because of the hostility he faced from the authorities there. The Labour peer recalled the now historic speech made by Mr. Mandela at his trial, in which he declared he was prepared to die.
He ended with the words, "I have cherished the ideal of a democratic and free society in which all persons live together in harmony and with equal opportunities. It is an ideal which I hope to live for and achieve, but if needs be, it is an ideal for which I am prepared to die." We, his lawyers, had advised him to delete the "prepared to die" sentence because it could be construed by the judge as an invitation to hang him.
Rejecting that advice, he told his lawyers he had to make that declaration so his followers would understand that no sacrifice was too great in the battle for freedom. It would inspire them, he said, to carry on when he was no longer there to lead them.
It was this indomitable courage which was the hallmark of Nelson Mandela. As a leader, he epitomised leadership, political genius, integrity, justice, forgiveness, generosity and humility.
Lord Joffe kept in touch with Mr. Mandela and visited him 3 years ago at his home in Johannesburg.
He was sitting on a low sofa in his living room, and being quite frail, he struggled to rise. I said, "Madiba, please do not get up for me." And he, with a mischievous twinkle in his eyes, replied as he rose, "I always stand up for a member of the House of Lords."
There was a little clip there from Today in Parliament this week, looking at Nelson Mandela. Martin, could you just sum up what your thoughts are seeing that memorial service this week?
What strikes me, people won't have heard the name that I will mention now, Chris Hani. Chris Hani was assassinated. He was the head of the South African Communist Party, and he was assassinated in the run-up to the first democratic election in South Africa. He was assassinated by Yanis Valush, who was a right-wing fanatic, basically. And the sad thing is that a whole generation of political leaders, many of them as gifted as Mandela, are no longer with us. And, of course, that means that they're no longer able to do the things that would have been possible had they lived. And I suspect that if Hani had lived, for example, the negotiations with the regime would have been much harder, and they would have demanded more concessions, particularly on economic issues. Because what Mandela did in the end, sadly, is in order to get the peace through quickly, they gave way on lots of the economic issues, which is why you've still got massive problems with poverty and exclusion in today's South Africa. Hey.
1976 there, Gil Scott-Heron from his album From South Africa to South Carolina with the song Johannesburg. We're joined by Esmond Jenkins. He's a Lib Dem councillor from the Cotswolds. Esmond, we mentioned at the start that you got involved particularly with the problems of planning and development. So tell us when you first realised that was a problem, because I understand you actually got elected on the back of doing something about what seemed to be corruption going on in the planning system, where an area in the Cotswold Water Park, beautiful area, is supposed to be a conservation area, and yet for some reason strange developments were popping up, actually multi-million pound developments.
Yeah, I mean, this has been going on since the early 1990s. Bear in mind, I only came to the area in 2004, and my specific interest to start with was just how this quarry had been manoeuvred into position.
So it started off as a kind of NIMBY thing. This was happening outside your
absolutely.
Back garden.
Yeah, unashamedly. The local population, in fact, a local landowner sort of came striding up to me with his walking stick and suggesting that a 6 foot high bund, earth bank, would be quite sufficient to protect us from the you know, the dust and the noise and all the rest that goes with gravel extraction. My initial reaction was over my dead body. I hadn't travelled all the way from leafy Surrey to live next to a quarry. So that was a selfish motivation. But we started, typical of a lot of areas, there were retired professionals and lawyers and architects, and there was a willing team of people who, once alert to potential wrongdoing, galvanised very quickly.
Now, I understand the Water Park Society is a quango, sort of offshoot from the council, and that was running quite nicely, chugging along, doing its job, conserving the water park. How did things go wrong and when?
Well, I mean, as with all these things, the society, the Water Park Society, was a quango set up by principally by Gloucestershire County Council to take charge of public administration in the Cotswold Water Park, which is an area of about 140 square miles, straddling Wiltshire and Gloucestershire. And it's basically the gravel beds surrounding the Upper Thames. And I think post-war gravel extraction had left areas of lakes with no apparent economic use and were just taken over by wildlife and nature. And it was out of that landscape that the Water Park Society was formed, funded by local authorities. And it was run by 10 or 15 very decent people drawn from the local society, local communities, with very strict conservation mandate, and they set about the job very effectively. And I think it soon became apparent that to the commercial interests in the water park that some of the planning permissions were being obstructed by this new quango, and that was probably evident by the year 2000-2001.
So these developers, how did they manage to get round the system? I mean, obviously they've spent a bit of money and time on preparing a planning application. That's been kicked back. But then things started to happen, didn't they? I mean, we had the disposal of Cane's Country Park and also places like Summer Lake. Now, the thing is, for a house builder, this is absolutely a wonderful territory, isn't it? If you can build a luxury house next to a lake, you're going to sell it for a million, if not millions.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, look, you have to follow the money with these things. The one development, south of Cirencester, has permission for 600 holiday homes. Now, when the planning permission was originally conceived, this was to be 600 log cabins, small caravan-sized developments, but developers set to work and expanded the brief so that we ended up with individual properties worth £3 million, £4 million. Now, you know, the mathematics suggests that even at £2 million or £1 million, 600 units, you're looking at perhaps £1 billion worth of development, £500 million worth of development. So huge sums of money are at stake, and with money comes influence, and with influence, developers do their utmost to win planning permissions.
Now, the fascinating thing is that this land, without the planning permission, is worth maybe a few £1,000 an acre. With the planning permission, it's worth millions an acre. So it's almost like a sort of money manufacturing machine.
Yeah, what you've got to understand is, first off, if you can win a gravel extraction license or planning permission, you can convert what is now probably £4,000-£5,000 an acre agricultural land to £300,000-£500,000 per acre in terms of value as a site for mineral extraction. Once you've dug your hole, you can earn another £300,000-£500,000 from infilling that hole with waste. Once you've completed that exercise, you can then sell it for £300,000-£400,000 as a brownfield site to developers. Now, the only thing to stopping you converting £4,000 an acre agricultural land to a multi-million pound return is two or three planning permissions.
Wow, amazing. So this is the local authority that's giving these planning. But, I mean, a lot of this has been covered in bits and pieces in Private Eye over the last, 5 years or so, and also in the Daily Telegraph. Tell us about some of the coverage you've got.
Yeah, I mean, this is apparently, after the Poulsen affair in the 1970s, this is the longest running article in or coverage that Private Eye have ever run, and it's been known, and it's echoed around Westminster and the House of Lords because it's a real insight to just how in my opinion corruption extends into a local authority, which on the surface looks very respectable. But once you start to lift the veneer of respectability, you start to understand what's really going on.
So how do just maybe one or two people, individual councillors on a planning committee, how do they actually control the committee? Because, I mean, one of the things that you've discovered is that it's not necessarily a majority of people on that planning committee. It's just one or two influential people there can actually get one of these planning decisions overturned.
Yeah, I mean, I think coming from a commercial background, and this is the, I think, why we've been so successful and so tenacious, is that people coming from a business background, sitting in on local authority committees, very quickly worked out that, you know, a 25-man committee can be dominated by one, two, or three people. Similarly, a 15-man or a 12-man planning committee can be dominated by two, three people. Once you understand and you watch a few of these, then you can see who the heavyweights are. And then what became apparent to us was that some of those heavyweights are very closely connected to the big commercial interests in the water park.
Fascinating. But are you saying that most of the people sitting around that planning committee table are like drones, just following the lead of some powerful people on the committee?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's probably true of councils up and down the country, regardless of political colour. Local politics is tribal, and what I've seen, certainly in my own council, is that a lot of power is concentrated in two, three, or four people.
So what connections did you find between these powerful people on the committees and the developers? And you managed to make some links, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, the leader of Cotswold District Council, and is still a chap called Lyndon Stowe, and there's his business partner, David Fowles. They ran a printing organisation.
But hang on, David, isn't he a councillor too?
David Fowles is a councillor. Both of them were in business, plying their trade, selling printing and media coverage to these major developers, and in particular the holiday home developers. That was one element, but they were also in business with Dennis Grant, the guy who went to jail for 4 years for fraud and theft over £1 million of assets of the Cotswold Water Park.
Crikey! Well, tell us about that, because I know he's just about to come out of jail, isn't he?
He's been out for a couple of weeks, as far as we know.
Okay, but, how did that case come about?
Well, very early on in 2008, this guy had, he started in 2006. He took over, he was invited to take over the Cotswold Water Park Society, which was the local authority sponsored quango, and very quickly set about transforming the way it did its business. And I think for those of us who were perhaps more sceptical of his motives, it became apparent that this guy was somebody who had very little interest in conservation and a great deal of interest in his own personal enrichment. And he openly courted commercial relationships with the big money men in the water park. These are the gravel digging companies and the after-use holiday home developers.
Okay, so what was he actually finally prosecuted for? Because I know that there are various potential things that people could be criminal offences. I mean, one is misconduct in public office, another is fraud or theft, and conspiracy, which is when various people get together to plan these frauds or theft of public land, public assets. What was he actually finally convicted for?
Well, I think that this is the essence of the water park scandal, is that this guy was benefiting, taking very large commissions from selling off taxpayer-owned assets.
He was in his own pocket, personally, or his own business?
Yeah, no. I mean, he organised the 114-year lease of the county council-owned Keynes Country Park to the developer for £1 a year, and he personally took a commission of £165,000 for that. There was the Water Park Society's own Gateway Centre, which is a very nice oak frame building built in 2002 at the entrance to the water park. He sold off for £1.8 million. and pocketed £400,000 for that. And there were other commissions. There was another sum which he took as £150,000, which was basically his undoing, which he took as a backhander from a developer for exclusive development rights around another lake.
Now he's gone to jail. Does that mean that the corruption is over at the water park?
No, well, it depends on who you speak to, but it was always my view that Dennis Grant was only part of the problem. People shouldn't have been conned that the fraud started and stopped with Dennis Grant. He facilitated a number of deals, but the beneficiaries were ultimately one of the major principal beneficiaries was the largest holiday home developer, second home developer in the water park.
Now, obviously, the police got him, but what about other police investigations, audits, and the ombudsman, that kind of thing? What's been going on? How many inquiries and what inquiries into what's happened?
In the first instance, we called the audit commission in because we were not happy at the way county council officials had handled the disposal of Kane's Country Park. It just didn't make sense to us. That audit commission report was pulled up prematurely when somebody made the decision that they'd closed the accounts for 2007 and therefore were not prepared to continue. We then went to the local government ombudsman. That investigation was running for about 18 months, and I think the watershed moment was March 2010 when I organised a public meeting which included our MP in a packed village hall, 350 people with television cameras and radio stations and local press there, and we had discovered £150,000 backhander, which the Dennis Grant and his Water Park Society couldn't explain. And it was 4 weeks after that Dennis Grant was arrested. And then his sidekick, a guy called Nick Hansen, who was his finance director, he suddenly dropped dead with a heart attack when he was arrested.
Now, I know he's not the only person to have died who's been involved in this investigation.
No, I mean, the Water Park scandal, I think, has sadly taken a number of lives. There's been a lot of stress and a lot of pressure on a lot of people.
And the journalist who was working with you on the Private Eye stories, just tell us a bit about him.
Yeah, well, he was a chap called Declan Cunningham, who wasn't a member of any political party, but joined with us in 2008 and offered his services to me as a PR man and as a journalist, and he was a very skilled one at that. And it was Declan that used to do a lot of the narratives which ended up in Private Eye covertly. I mean, that's never been made public knowledge, but I'm sure his family wouldn't, now he's gone, will not mind.
Also, yourself, you were subjected to what can really only be called bullying and harassment. I mean, just tell us about that. I mean, trying to get you dismissed as a councillor.
Yeah, I mean, I think you become, as I say, I've become very sceptical about local politics as a result of my experiences. But bear in mind that the arrest of Dennis Grant was in April 2010. And by the end of 2010, the police had wound down their investigation into wrongdoing in the water park. And they decided that it was merely fraud and theft, i.e. that Dennis Grant had stolen from his employer. And it was always my point that that couldn't have been the case. Nevertheless, by 2011, early 2011, to all observers, the police had no longer any interest in the water park. In February 2011, there was a development at Kane's Country Park which involved fleets of lorries bringing in infill from places as far afield as Bristol and Reading to fill in one of the conservation, the nature reserves on at the lakes. It was called Lake 31 at Keynes Park, which met with outrage from local people because there was no planning permission for this. And when we raised it with the local authority, the planning department didn't want to know, nor did David Newdegg, the chief executive of Cotswold District Council, nor did his auditor. And neither did the police when we alerted them. So eventually, in February, I arranged for a senior officer of Cotswold District Council to attend the site so that we could measure the extent of the infill, which was causing so much local concern. What happened was little short of a Andrew Mitchell-style stitch-up, because I was accused of abusive language and threatening behaviour. That evening, a police officer phoned me up and announced that a complaint had been made that I had used threatening behaviour, which I denied. And when I pointed out that actually there were two parish councillors with me who would attest to what went on, the police action was dropped. However, what continued was a Standards Board for England complaint raised by the developer, Max Thomas, with the support of an enforcement officer from the Environment Agency, this being the enforcement officer responsible, in theory, to prevent any illegal infilling of the many lakes in the water park.
It sounds all a little bit perverse, that, because there you are explaining that the environment is being abused, and then you've got the Environment Agency actually backing a complaint against you.
Well, more specifically, the Environment, just to put it into context, the developer, Max Thomas, and his Watermark group, who'd got hold of the lake courtesy of the jailed fraudster, had a permission to remodel the banks of this nature reserve, Lake 31, which by a surveyor's calculation should have required no more than 5,000 tonnes of earth being brought in. What the council eventually had to admit was that in excess of 40,000 tonnes of earth had been brought in. Now, for those who know anything about the infilling or landfilling, a lorry load of infill taken to a landfill site will attract significant sums of tax and is an expensive option for a developer. So the dumping of earth from 20 ton lorries reputedly attracts £100-200 payment each time. And we calculated that the developer who'd undertaken the illicit infill had benefited to the tune of £500,000. Nevertheless, I raised this upon the request of local authority of local parishes, and then I found myself facing a Standard Board's complaint, which is a very serious complaint of bullying and abusive language and bringing my position into disrepute.
Okay, Esmond Jenkins there, and we'll carry on chatting to Esmond after the news further into that story. After the news also, hundreds of ordinary people in the southwest continue to give up their free time to campaign against the proposed nuclear power station. That's after the Murdoch news at 6 o'clock.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 6, Nigella Lawson's former PA has told